This is for the nerds, this is for the brainiacs, this is what we deserve. Go ahead and play it back, you ain't gonna touch me. You're not gonna do nothing, you are not above me. I bet you wish you was me, I know that I know.
What is poppin', everybody? And welcome back to another special episode of the Only Friends Podcast. Well, you know, it's me and my only friends, which includes, but is not limited to...
That buzzing.
That little bit of buzz that Landon keeps creating.
Is it gone?
Sorry, I had to extend that a little.
It's gone now.
Your only friend is the buzz, and the buzz is left.
That makes no fucking sense, man.
The buzz is gone.
What makes no sense is that Guapo was the one who got up and unplugged your laptop instead of you getting up and doing
it. I was getting up, and he looked at me, and I was like, all right, you got it, bro.
Listen, Guapo is like, you know, he's a one-man show. He just does it all.
Okay? He's well-rested. I can see it.
Mm-hmm.
Took a couple years off.
Did you get a good night's sleep?
Dude, I feel so good.
Yeah. What are you going to do with all your energy now?
I'm going to make a GTO Wizard short tonight. And then
so right back to work.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to work. So I'm going to make a GTO Wizard short. And I'm going to study some heads-up charts because Landon was chastising me for not three-betting the Queen-8 off.
You folded Queen-8 off to an open.
To an open?
To an open?
You just folded?
Just folded.
What hands do you call with? This is heads up, the button versus big blind.
Yeah, and I was playing a really
They were
good
literally
player.
Playing heads up.
And you, wait, so where, what do you do with queen seven?
I'll three bet that one.
What are you saying off for? You fold, obviously. What are you doing with jack?
don't tell me what I'm doing.
Well, you can't fold queen eight and call queen seven.
Listen, I've got a method to my madness.
What do you do with king five?
I'm always calling.
Well, it's a three
it's
bet.
King five suited, I'm going to three bet sometimes too.
It's the opposite. It's okay. Heads up's hard. However, I would honestly, who's tight in this room? Actually, all three of you.
I would be willing to go.
When you say all three of you,
I mean you, Conrad and Guapo.
Yeah. That wasn't that hard.
It was clearly not me and Landon.
I can't wait to see what this entails.
I would be willing to go toe to toe with everybody in this room except Lando and Six Max preflop, as far as like who hits like the frequencies the best.
I think
preflop in my Six Max game.
So I challenge you, give it to me, Max GTO Wizard over 500 hands.
Preflop, sure,
deal.
See, I want an excuse to play as many hands as I possibly can play.
Okay, so there are a few things happening at once here. I'm gonna try to take one at a time. First of all, I don't think that's a point of pride the way that you believe it to be, Guapo.
What? That I played well preflop?
Yes. Pretty much, yeah. Yeah.
Why is that not something to take pride in?
Yeah,
Here's my personal takeaway, and like, look, if you're playing online, of course, it's.
He is playing online.
I'm playing online.
Yeah, well, you also live in Las Vegas, and there's a lot of fucking money if you just get off your ass and go down.
I still want to hear why I shouldn't take pride in this. Well,
if you're strictly playing online, fine. But the other issue, regardless of if you're playing strictly online or live, the issue with taking so much pride in playing the preflop street perfectly is that it doesn't allow you to then adapt. What I have found personally is people who are very prideful about their preflop construction and nailing all the frequencies to a degree where like they're rolling pocket eights versus low jack open.
What does that mean?
That they're mixing their frequency with eights versus a low jack open between call and fold or three bet and fold. I don't know
what the word rolling meant.
I don't even know what the fuck they're mixing it between, to be quite honest.
Here, just don't fold.
Yeah, that would be anyway, my point is people who are that prideful about their preflop construction, they lack the ability to adapt because they're too rigid. They're too bought into the preflop system that they've studied and learned. I am of the impression, or at least the way I approach the game, is that everything that we study and learn in theory is strictly a guideline.
Strictly what?
A guideline. Not well. Don't say well. Of course.
What do you mean? Why not?
Because if you're
are you
pridefully
assuming
saying
that I have the inability to change gears if I'm playing against like somebody who's playing like a 70% VPIP.
Well, I can answer this one. I don't think it's that you have the inability.
Change gears.
I think you get set in your ways with the pre-flop chart. Like when we're talking about like, you know, three betting like king five suit or 6-5 suited and
playing
six five suited. Just like the different things, you're like, you can't play that hand profitably. You just can't play that hand profitably. I'm like, what do you mean? Like, of course I can't. You can play any hand profitably depending on the situation.
Well, that's not
true. I mean, to a degree. But like the fringes, right? Like stuff that's like borderline, stuff that mixes, stuff that's one pip off. In certain situations, they all become profitable.
One pip's on the floor, right?
Yeah, there's a pip.
There's a pip right on the floor.
Yeah.
I think Brian's point's true.
Yeah.
I think his qualification of his point is true.
Thank you.
You can't play any hand profitably. But I do think that what he's saying or what he's speaking to is the system through which you are indoctrinated. Feels like a harsh word, but it feels appropriate. And it's not a slight, because obviously you derive a lot of win rate from being good pre, right? So if you have shortcomings post flop, being really good pre is going to mitigate those. Mm-hmm. So that's a really great thing. I'm speaking more to the broader picture of, I would personally, if you gave me two different player types, one of which who was very strict to nailing everything pre-flop, mm-hmm. and the other of which was trying to be thoughtful or mindful pre-flop, but was largely just playing intuitively based off of their observation of game flow and their opponents and things like that, I would take the latter.
Again, but this is under the pretext that I can't change my game versus someone.
It's not that
who
you can't.
Has a leak.
Well, it's not that you can't. It's just that you're not incentivized to. So, define a leak. Like, define someone, an obvious leak that you would notice.
Someone who's playing way too many hands. Someone who's limp calling a lot.
Okay.
That's somebody who I would certainly change.
But what would you change? Strategy with. What would you change?
I'd be a lot wider. I'd want to play more heads up pots with them if I'm on the button or if I'm in the cutoff and they're limping from the low jack or the high jack. Like,
okay, so this is a perfect example.
Sure.
The reason you're strict to your preflop charts to begin with is because it's all dependent upon one another. So every action that takes place creates a reaction from everyone who's left to act, right?
Sure.
If somebody's limping and calling too often, and you now decide to expand your range, you become exploitable to everybody who's left to act.
If they're exploiting me, sure.
Well, why wouldn't they?
You'd be surprised.
No, I wouldn't. That's my whole point.
So you think
that's why I wouldn't be strict to a preflop template to begin with, because I'm not surprised at all the mistakes that people make. And so I would never want to find myself folding eights pre to a single open, in spite of the fact that the charts say to. You see what I'm saying?
I understand your argument. Yes.
Again, like I know I framed this initially as like a bit of a jab, but it's not meant to be, because I do think that especially in a strict online environment where, you know, rake is relatively
this
high.
This is where Guapo has put the majority of his volume.
Of course,
in,
but like when
fair.
You go play live, like people are just, Landon and I were talking about this earlier today. Like I played a pretty tough three-handed game last night. And I was like, you know, I would have rather been playing like 200, 400 than 1-1, because there just isn't a lot of win rate. Like, you know, the biggest loser in the game might be losing like 5 big blinds per 100. And that's now getting divvied up between two people. So you're just not winning much, and you want to play a lot bigger so that your hourly is at least worth it. And Landon's like, yeah, but I mean, like, you know, maybe someone's punting. Like, it might be a good spot. I go, yeah, it could be. But, like, think about when I'm playing Ring, and there are a handful of guys in the game that are losing, like, 50 big blinds per 100. Like, you're just able to win so much fucking mm-hmm. money, right? And so the reason why I demonstrate those two examples is because that three-handed match is much more like online, where you're really trying to chisel out your win rate. Whereas the Ring game that I generally get to play with people who, like, you know, are making errors in every node of the tree, it's just literally free money that you get to pick and choose how you collect it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the difference between like live and online. Live is going to be the availability to a win rate of like, you know, 20 big blinds an hour, 15 big blinds an hour in certain spots. Online is going to be like 2 or 3 big blinds per hour.
There's like a lot of hands that, like, if you look at the charts, like, well, these aren't profitable to open, right? Because of the response of the people behind you, right? But like when you're playing live and their 3-bet range is 1/5 of what it should be, now these hands that weren't profitable now are.
Right, right. A lot of the EV of specific hands as they approach zero is derived from the ability to realize. And that's why you'll see them go from like being zero EV or even negative up front to being a profitable hand on the button.
Right. Less people, less chance of you getting 3-bet. Less chance of you being in an unprofitable situation.
Well, it's more specific than that. It's that you are, the closer you are to closing action post flop, the more streets of realization you're going to naturally acquire.
Right.
Which will now allow hands that easily are denied when they're forced to play out of position, start to profit, right? But to your point, when people are just naturally too passive and they don't respond appropriately with enough aggression after the flop, they don't deny you your equity.
Right.
So, you know, bringing it all the way back, forgetting about the specifics of the fringe of range construction, but bringing it all the way back, the best players in live environments are printing because they over-realize compared to the field.
Yeah, so it would be like, you know, these hands that you probably aren't supposed to open early are now now you are opening them knowing that there are better hands behind you and they are going to respond with a VPIP, but in a way that allows you to realize the equity that your hand does possess.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. If they're going to check back too many streets, if they're going to fold too many gut shots or bottom pairs or middle pairs or whatever, like if you just get to barrel them off when you have equity. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. It's a fine line to walk, and you have to have pretty sharp post-flop skills. So, again, like I want to make it very clear that I'm not trying to take a shot at Guapo because I do think that this is a big strength of his, right? It's just it's one that you want to build off of rather than take so much pride in that you get restricted to it, right? I think that becomes like the challenge where, you know, like. I don't know how he plays now. It's been a while since we played together, but like when Christian was like really, really, really heavy into the charts, he was a worse player because like he just took himself out of action in good spots. You know, it's like you're just in a good game and all of a sudden like you're just folding hands that do really well against weak opposition. And if you go play live, that's most of what you're going to be up against. So like, you know, in your spot, Guapo, if you've already learned preflop really well, you can take that to a live room and not be afraid to overstep.
Yeah,
right?
It's like under the gun 8 opens, you have 6s in the cutoff, and you start folding because you're like, oh, the machine gets to fold here a lot of the time.
Right.
You're just like
nothing bad happens by calling.
I actually don't even
have
a calling range.
Right. Like, I think that's a problem live. Right? Because, like, it's so much of a cooperative environment.
Just 3-better fold. Or at least that's what I'm playing. 6 max.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't be playing my buttons that way.
And alive, you do a lot of calling.
Yeah, alive's so fascinating to me because, you know, I'm fortunate enough to get to play an ante game with no rake.
Yeah,
so it's like, different. You just get to call a lot anyway.
Yeah.
Right? Like, significantly, people have no idea. You have no idea.
I mean, tournament players do. This game.
Yeah.
Because
well, sort of.
It's like our big blind defend range. Okay,
well, it's not. No, it's not that. It's like, it's actually like the small blind you get to call a ton from. But I also play the same blind game, which even increases it more. Like, people misplay the small blind so fucking badly in my game. They just don't defend it enough. Mm-hmm. Nowhere near enough. And you're right. Like, tournament players do understand to a degree, but like, the lack of depth also swings things. They get the VPIP the way we get the VPIP, but they don't necessarily have calling ranges the way live players do. Yeah. But yeah, it's like, it's pretty fascinating. I think the evolution of theory into practice. And this is the bigger point that I want to hone in on because I think we're getting a little bogged down by maybe me incorrectly messaging that preflop doesn't matter. It does matter. It absolutely matters. And being,
fundamentally.
Being fundamental and having a comprehensive strategy preflop is worth a lot. But what I'm getting at is, at the end of the day, the advancement of our tools and the quote-unquote science of no limit right now is very much in its infancy. So very little of what we are confident in right now is hardened fact, right? And we should be able to see this just through testing. We watch people be big winners not obeying preflop charts, mm-hmm. not obeying post-flop sizing schemes according to the solver and things of that nature. And it's difficult to just call them outliers, right? They're clearly preying upon something because that's the way the game works. EV is exchanged, right? If you're a big winner and you're doing something that is slightly against theory or a little bit wider than theory, a little bit tighter than theory or whatever, but it's drastically increasing your bottom line over a reasonable sample, well, you're taking advantage of something in the pool that isn't correcting for this, right? They're willingly giving you EV and you're taking it through these methods without like any communication between one another. So if we know that to be true, then what we should understand is the purpose of study is to pull out the principles and just understand like basic guardrails for what is and is not acceptable whenever you are gambling. And from there, it's like, it is about putting your own little twist on it. It is about freestyling a bit. It's about having a pip or two too wide or too tight in certain spots. It's about, you know, knowing and being conscious of the times where your range is bounded and you have no bluffs because you are the only one privy to that information. Your opponent has to assume, and this is the danger of, I think this is why people have become like so anti-GTO. Like if you heard Doug talk about the way he approaches the game, he doesn't try to decipher, like he doesn't want to go through the logical fallacies or the circular logic of, well, he thinks that I think that he thinks that I think that he thinks, you know what I mean? And that's reasonable because there's no, it's a dead end, right? But if you just always operate off the aspect of, well, I know what happens here in theory and I'm just going to assume my opponent is rational and is making theoretical decisions, you get fucked. You get fucked bad on the fringes.
Mm-hmm.
Because most people are not rational according to the definition of rational actor in theory. And you have to be making pretty vast adjustments whenever you are, you know, I call it the fringes, but really it's like whenever the closer to zero EV you are, the more radical the adjustments you have to make. And that's why like when we're talking about just pay, We're not talking about hands that are approaching zero, right? We're talking about hands that are approaching value, but because the environment is a specific way, they decrease drastically, mm-hmm. right? Because the environment's too tight in certain ways, they decrease drastically. Whenever we start to approach zero in a lot of these environments where people are to something, we make a really radical adjustment, either folding way more often or raising way more often, right? And I don't think preflop's any different.
Mm-hmm.
I squeeze hand. I mean, the 3 and 4 bet pots that I play are gross. Like, honestly, if you could pull out the data points and like just look at a large sample of how 3, 4, and 5 bet pots are played in Bobby's room when you're 1,000 blinds deep,
mm-hmm.
it's actually mind bending how awful the hand selections are. But it's really not about that point, right? It's about getting to the flop with a relative SPR and seeing who understands the range composition between the two players better. And you could just tell all the time that there are a lot of people who are just weak at comprehending this, right? Like I played a 5-bet pot the other day, Kings versus Aces, and it came Jack-Jack-7 rainbow. It went small bet call at an SPR of like 6. Turn is a 10, goes check-check. And for what it's worth, like I'm not playing my hand well either, but I was pretty confident I was against aces. Mm-hmm. So check back turn, river's now a 9, only completing king queen. He checks again, and my only thought here with an SPR of like 2 is, can I bluff my hand?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I ultimately decided no, check down and lose to aces. But to not understand how money goes in there is very clearly not understanding how ranges are comprised, right? And it's the fear of, well, I don't want to stack off to a jack. But it's like you're always going to stack off to a jack, and I don't have that many of them. It's mm-hmm. a 5-bet pot, you mm-hmm. know? It's like there are just very, very few, even as the widest guy in the room. It's like, well, if I do have a lot of jack X, I also have a lot of other things
yeah.
that are like willing to pay. I have a lot of 10X. I have a lot of, you know, 9X and queens and kings and all these other hands that I'm going to be put into a tough decision to bluff catch with. So like when you have the aces, you just make it a two or three street game and you play all in. But the nature of the game is as you progress through the bets and ranges are supposed to tighten, nobody knows to the degree at which we over or under correct. Right. And then just fear takes over at that point. Right. So it's just like, okay, well, what are we doing? You know, that's kind of like a long-winded way of saying that it's great that you know your frequencies really well pre, but I would be a little bit more conditioned to just treat that as a template. Because here's the other thing. You know those frequencies really well, right? But you're talking about six max, two blind, no ante, moderate rake.
Sure.
If I change any one of those variables, you don't know shit.
Right.
That's a problem. That means that you were never thinking pre. Right? It just means that you were replicating a chart that you saw.
It was just rote memory, yeah.
Right. And that becomes really problematic because though it's great that you have a picture in your head of what rangers are supposed to look like, the second that somebody adjusts in some sort of capacity, because it's not just about changing the variables of the blind structure or the ante structure or the rake structure, it's also about changing the variables of the players that you're up against. So if somebody in the pool is very bad in a specific way, and your opponents around you are adjusting their entire preflop strategy based off of that bad player in order to extract EV, and you're just sticking to your guns, you're probably taking the worst of it in some sort of capacity, right?
If I'm not changing, yes.
Right, but what would incentivize you to change if you're not aware that that's taking place?
My argument has and still is that I'm pretty aware of who's got big leaks.
Right, but what if it's just a small leak?
Then I wouldn't.
That's what I'm saying. So like if player A to your left is three betting wider because player B to his left is too tight versus three bets in front of him, but is very aggressive with his own three bet strategy, right? Or plays no flats similar to yourself, right? Like it's something that simple. What if just the difference between the player on your left, And the pool, what if the difference is he plays flats when certain players are playing and he plays no flats when other players are playing? That will impact your strategy drastically if it's known. But if it's not known, you're forced to just execute as is, right? And you're giving something up on the margins. Yeah. And that's not to say that you could do better because maybe you don't know that about this player. But the whole point is that the second that people around you are changing their ranges, and you know, it could just simply be that they're fish, right? Fish will not play theoretical ranges, therefore their ranges have changed, and therefore your ranges should also change. But if we don't ever think about that kind of stuff, and we don't think about how we should be adapting and adjusting, then we just don't. And it's not that we don't lose money, because you're obviously executing a profitable strategy, but we lose EV that could be gained by playing the game with them, right? By just trying to outthink, outmaneuver, and out freestyle them in real time. And I think that like the more you move into live, the more obvious this will become, right? Because people just stink so bad. Even if you funnel them to top, they play top so bad that it's kind of okay. You know, it's just an upfront investment to get them to make mistakes on later streets.
So while Berkey was in his long-winded way of trying to fucking ruin my action, you want to do it on Skype? We'll make a little content out of it. Have some fun. Where we share each other's screens.
Yeah, Skype, sure. What is this, 2008?
Oh, whatever. Not Skype, but whatever. Discord, there we go. Sorry, the new Discord.
Use AIM Messenger.
Skype? Ooh, yo, AIM Messenger on this fucking sidekick? You guys don't know about the sidekick.
Skype, mm-hmm. Skype was just for the early days of video sexting.
No.
Yeah,
no.
Bro. Yeah, bro. No. Yeah, it's like, you want Skype? And it's always like it's always like an eggplant emoji or the peach, you know.
Fucking,
you just get the WYD question mark. It's like nothing. I'm home. Skype peach. Yeah, man.
It was the best. Missed my away messages.
Oh man.
Before my time.
Way before your time.
That was a good intro. That was a little heavy. A little heavy on the strat intro.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes
you don't want to be a shit rag.
Give them what they want.
Don't play charts. I'm kidding, Guapo. You're not a shit rag.
That's debatable.
I mean, you might be heads up. It does sound like
you hear his live antics.
I missed the segue I was trying to say, but the three of you, and I didn't realize this truthfully, until I started to get into it. The three of you would benefit a lot from studying heads up. And I'm noticing this more and more and more. It's kind of ironic because I think people who strictly come from a heads up background have a lot of flaws when they go into ring.
I would assume they're too wide.
Yeah. And not just pre, but most specifically it's really a framework issue. Like the way that they think about the game is troublesome because in heads up you don't really have to be that considerate of your opponent's range because they're playing
just
deck.
Wide.
Yeah, they're just playing deck.
Yeah.
So all you really have to worry about managing is your range and your frequencies. Mm-hmm. There was a Polk thread that was put out a few weeks ago or maybe a week and a half ago. We were going to use this as like kind of a jumping off point. And I think it's really relevant. He basically said like you know, his foray into ring games has not gone well. He's down like 400K and you know, he wants to start examining a little bit more and studying more and yada yada. And like, look, Doug's a world-class player. Like it certainly could just get chalked up to variance. I think he even followed up and said, but if I didn't randomize aces versus ace jack and I call, I'm up like $1 million or something like that. But I think what he highlights here is exactly what happens for most heads-up players. He says, what I struggle with the most is having to think about what my opponent has. That sounds sort of funny to say, but in heads-up, you don't really have to think so much about what someone has nearly as often. Ranges are super wide, and both players have tons of good hands. You just need to have a focus on your range and how to divide it up based on the combo's balance, ratios, defending enough. There are exceptions. Preflop caller won't have top hands, but generally speaking, ranges tend to be symmetrical and wide enough to where you can spend your time thinking about how to play all of your hands. Ring games are almost the exact opposite of this. Tons of very specific ranges all over the place. Multi-way flops, stand-up game, triple straddles. I'm going to try to focus a little more on trying to figure out what people have when I play ring poker. Maybe I'll get back to even at some point. We will see. Now, I think that thread really highlights a lot of the difference in mindset between heads-up and ring. And why, like, you know, all of these heads up for roles, like if you're so good, why don't you just play another good player heads up for all of it type of stuff? It's like, well, like personally, I'd been a ring game my entire life. I never played heads up, never prior to airball. And I wasn't kidding. Like, I think people think that like I was sandbagging in some capacity. Mm-mm. I never fucking studied heads up. The little bit of heads up that I did play was against like Lucky, you know, and it was literally just, it was an exercise in just trying to figure out how to exploit somebody who's heavily exploitable in real time, right? Like, I didn't learn any ranges. I was probably doing similar shit to Guapo, like just folding queen eight versus an open because the fuck am I going to do? This guy's too tight to begin. You know, all kinds of wild stuff. Now, granted, it's not really in my nature to fold, so I probably didn't fold like queen eight, but, you know, whatever. Yeah. I'm sure I made preflop errors, tons of them. In studying for the airball match, what I came to realize is a lot of what Doug talks about in that thread, where the whole exercise now is just strictly about you and how you navigate your frequencies, your ranges, how you ensure that you're not overdoing something or underdoing something. And structurally speaking, I highlighted a lot of this in the game plan course that I put out after the airball match on Solve4Y TV, Solve4Y.io, if you guys are interested. The framework through which you study heads up is so, so very different, right? Like, I'm sure a lot of online guys study them very similarly, but like live, you just don't. I don't spend a lot of time when it comes to my ring study figuring out what my turn probe frequency will be and like, what sizings, like what my sizing scheme for turn probes are going to be. It's like, oh, I want to have a B150 and I want to have a B30 and I need to figure out, like, you know, because generally if you're probing turn, it's four ways, you know? So it's like, you got to intuit some things. You got to freestyle a little bit. There's so much in ring that like, there's so many extra variables in ring that you have to consider that having some rigid structure to, okay, this is my turn probe sizing scheme. I'm going to have two sizes and these are going to be it. For everybody at home, turn probe is when you're after check, you lead out of position. So basically the initiative is up for grabs again and the out of position player takes the lead. You just don't really consider those things, but in heads up, you have to because it's symmetrical. There's every node in the tree is being played equally by both players. And you only have one other person to consider. So you have a C-bet range and sizing scheme. You have a check-raising scheme. You have a turn probe size and scheme. You have a delay C-bet size and scheme. You just rigidly plan all of these things, right? So you build this map. And it's just your map of sizes that are equated to all the different betting structures that can take place. C-bet and single raise pot, C-bet and 3-bet pot, C-bet and 4-bet pot, et cetera, right? And they all come with different ranges. So in a single raise pot, you're obviously going to have deck. In a 3-bet pot, you're going to have like a third of the deck, whatever. When it's all said and done, when it's all broken down, you really get this perspective of how do I polarize a range while still navigating this massive, massive portion of my range that is non-polar, right? And that really drives logical, deductive reasoning in real time. Because it's not really about figuring out what your opponent's bluff catching with and stuff like that. It's just about figuring out, does my hand qualify and am I overdoing it type of thing. And I think that this is where the vast majority of my edge versus airball came from. Like, sure, I probably ran above expectation. But I also think that, you know, barring giving him a lot of time to study, his brain doesn't think that way. He thinks like a ring player. So when the big bet comes in on the river, it's just like, oh man, like, you know, what hands can he be betting 300% pot with here? Like, he has so many nutted hands, I don't have any, or he has like all of these nutted hands and my hand doesn't block it or whatever. And there's just like no bluffs. Where it's like, you know, it's a single raise pot. You have deck to bluff with. You always have deck to choose from to bluff with.
Yeah, it's like the classic six max or ring player over bluff heads up is they just have too many hands and like right. Bet check bet or like bet, where it's like, oh, I have jack six high. It's like, well, you could have checked back the turn.
Right.
I have queen high. Yeah, you could check back flop.
Right. So that's why I'm saying that it's such a great way to learn for you three because you're not heads up specialists. And it did wonders for me. For the same reason, because if you learn heads up to begin with, then you just become the guy who's like way too wide and way too aggressive in all nodes. And you punt a little bit to somebody who's sharp on that. But like for someone like me, that's my natural inclination anyway, right? So like I'm always just like the action. I'm always the guy who's too wide. I have too many hands. I'm c-betting too often. What ended up happening for me was it allowed me to become more precise, right? So it wasn't about me becoming suddenly too wide. We saw this with Daniel when he went from playing Doug heads up to going back to playing a little bit of live stream cash. He was just all over the place. Just everything was a good bluff candidate, right? And you forget that, like, oh, you're against really tight fucking ranges,
right?
You know, the small blind flatted you when you opened the low jack. Yeah. That's not much of a range,
right?
And you can't treat it as though it's like a heads up big blind defense. So for me, I intuitively understood ring ranges really fucking well. And all it allowed me to do was now, because I already thought the way that I saw the game was never about my range. It was always about their range. I didn't care about my range, right? Because all I cared about was getting the response that I was after. If I wanted to find overfolds, then I needed to find a range that was too dense to weak hands. Right. And I would prey upon that. If I wanted to find thin value, then I needed to find a range that was too dense to bluff catchers. And I would prey upon that. And that was the way that I always saw it. Right. It was always just like, okay, I have a really good comprehension of my opponent's range, and I'm going to take the exploitative action that earns the most. But whenever I was forced to now think very heavily about my own range, now all of a sudden some precision started to fall into place. It was like, oh, well, we don't always have to do this, right? Like, we can focus on that portion of their range when we specifically unblock it with, like, this portion of our range. And now, all of a sudden, like, everything started to click really heavily. So, like, for the three of you who are, like, maybe really well-constructed pre or maybe even a little bit too tight in spots, now, all of a sudden, this gives you a lot of freedom and framework where it's, like, you are now considering a little bit of, like, what's my turn probe sizing going to be? What, you know what I mean? Because like now you're quantifying the actions that you're taking. And I just think that's worth so much in game. It alleviates so much of the decision fatigue of just being in one specific spot in this exact moment wanting an outcome and then trying to like precisely zone in on the exact hand that you're targeting. It's like the game just doesn't work that way. You
it
know?
Never worked that way.
I mean,
it did, but that's not the way it works.
It's not ideal. If it does work that way, mistakes may have been made previously, right?
Or like you have enough info to get to that point.
Right.
Like someone did something somewhere.
Someone did something a little out of line.
Or like someone did something where you have some sort of read or whatever.
Yeah.
That you can, I guess, have enough data for. But the game is not meant to pinpoint a hand. It's meant to play versus a range.
Right. Right. Even if that range is tight.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think learning how to play deck is the best exercise anybody could have. And I think doing it after the fact of learning how not to play deck and like being a tight, solid, aggressive player is even more freeing, right? It's similar to the idea of like learn PLO in the process of learning Hold'em, because it unlocks a lot of comprehension of like board textures and how it intertwines. I think all of these little pockets of the game within the game really help unlock like just strong aggressive play that's so heavily rewarded in these passive environments. That's my take. I don't know.
And that's why you call with queen eight.
I would like some action. I would like to get some action down on you two.
That's cool. Somebody already texted me that they want some action, so.
Okay, and they want Guapo?
Yep. No, they want me.
Are they crazy?
Sure.
Connie's pretty sharp. I've seen his numbers on Wizard.
Conrad versus Guapo, heads up.
Okay.
For souls.
We can do full hand, too, if you want.
Full hand, you'll kill me.
You both just can play
my post-flop.
No I think bueno. You both should do it in... I don't think it's interesting to see what you guys have memorized. I think you both should do it in a structure that you don't know.
Mm. I mean,
I have a feeling Connie's going to do really well.
I'm
like, I think you guys
Conrad
should...
has played all the structures.
Yeah, I mean, like, when I study, I literally go through 1, 2, 3. Do straddle, antique, MTT.
I think you regular. Guys. Yeah, I think you guys should study like.
I'm not studying.
No rake. Well, no, like play against one another.
Okay.
No I think rake. You guys should do like 2 blind, no rake.
2 blind, no rake.
Yeah, I can set it up. I can set up custom. I'll use our solve for Y ranges. I shouldn't have told you guys that because now you're going to cheat. You don't know which one I'm going to use.
I'm not looking at them.
Study them all.
Study them all.
I'm going to fucking cheat.
I think it would be interesting to have you guys play against each other with ranges that you don't know because it forces. It forces you to adjust in real time. So it makes you actually think about how you're constructing.
And we got to be on Discord looking at each other so I can talk shit.
Yeah. Well, yeah, for that's sure. The only reason to really do it.
Right.
At the end of the day.
This is going to be a very humbling experience.
For who?
Conrad?
For me.
Maybe not. If it really just comes down to the hands that mix, and if you can understand why they mix in each direction, like what incentivizes the mix, you'll
I think
get
it
right, I think.
I think it would do just fine, Guapo.
Yeah, you're going to do thanks, just fine. All right, enough all right. Poker talk for now.
Ryan Reynolds hit a home run yesterday.
Good for him.
Who?
I'll tell you who hit a home run yesterday. If you guys, did you guys watch any of the games?
Not Kentucky.
Not
Jack Golke.
Not Kentucky, yes.
The car salesman,
We jinxed Kentucky. We really did.
To be fair, Calipari hasn't won a fucking game in
that's
years.
Amazing.
Golke fucking lit it up, baby. These memes are so good. Have you seen Tommy Boy Landon or are you too young?
Too young.
God damn Tommy it, Boy. Man. What? God, this is so depressing.
I don't think funny movies are funny. So
okay, so Tommy
them.
Boy is Zelensky Motors and they're selling brake pads and Dan Aykroyd plays Zelensky. The meme is this guy looks exactly like him. One of them was, my name's Golke. I make threes for the American working man because that's who I am and that's who I care about. There was another meme going around saying that you're going to have this guy 10 years from now in your 7th grade physics class and he's going to be like, yeah, I dropped 32 on Kentucky in the NCAA bracket. No big deal. I don't mean to brag.
Hey, it's not over yet. They might win.
That's true. They might win. I don't have Oakland winning it. I just
look
don't.
Look at that.
This is his spray chart for the year. 347 3-point attempts. Look how many times he shot from inside the paint.
Wait,
that is
no,
10
times.
Absurd.
Eight times. He has 8 2-point attempts all season long.
And they're like fast split break transition layups or dunks?
There's literally one pull-up.
He's from, what we call a specialist.
There's one pull-up from like near the foul line.
You get he's in there and you do hits, one you thing. Fucking yak some threes.
He went 10 for 20 from beyond the arc yesterday.
He was 7 for 12 in the first half.
And the thing was, it was a 3-point game the entire time too, so it wasn't even enough to like pull them away.
Yeah,
Kentucky
for a minute early, but like yeah.
Yeah, Kentucky kind of shit down their leg.
10 for 20 sounds bad. Is that good?
No, 50% from beyond the arc is good.
Okay,
beyond
that's
good.
That's a good.
Especially
day.
As a college.
If you play,
yeah,
if you play, yeah, they don't exactly shoot lights out in college. And you play, and your team is always 50% from three. And they only shot threes, they would probably win a lot of games.
Yeah.
I would say all of them, actually.
Every single like one. You shoot
certainly
15.
Most. So that was a 14-3 upset.
Do you know what his 3-point shot percentage was throughout the year?
I don't.
Oh, okay. There was some kid on Creighton that's shooting 45%. I was like, what?
Damn.
That's absurd.
Probably a white guy.
Steph numbers, man.
Definitely a white guy.
Definitely a white guy.
I don't even know if Steph put up those numbers.
Probably not in college.
That shit is absurd.
Steph didn't do those numbers in college, but Steph was like, he was very good.
I mean, he put up numbers, but not, he put up a lot of shots.
Honestly, I didn't know anything about him until the NCAA run.
Curry?
Yeah.
I don't think anybody did.
Davison, right?
Yeah.
Steph Curry, 42%.
42?
22-23 season.
That's NBA. Yeah. Are you looking at college?
No, I was looking up Jack Golkies.
Golkies.
Percentage.
Man.
Nope.
Okay. Still on Conrad.
Oh, we're on me? Hey.
Right.
We got all the puppies here. We should have them all on the camera.
Poor Pip. She's falling off of her bed.
That's how she sleeps.
She likes that.
Pip's cracked.
I think we need a Pip cam.
Yep.
I want to put her back on my lap, but I don't want to disturb her.
I know.
Let her cook. She's cooking.
I'm so sad already. The first week that I had her, she was like still in like cuddle with like her brothers and sister mode. You know what I mean? So like she would just like ball up and like really nestle herself between like my shoulder and like the side of my neck. I was like, man, as long as she's this small, I could just get used to this, you know? Like, this is great. But obviously, she's going to get bigger at some
point.
There
we go. Pip cam.
Hey, Pippers. How'd you know?
She knows.
How'd you know? Come here, girl.
Six Max comfortable. Six Max are playing heads up.
But she's so she's grown a little bit in, like, the last week. Probably put on, like, a pound. Maybe grew an inch or two. And she's already to the point where she, like, wants her own space. So now instead of sleeping like all balled up like she used to, now she sleeps like this, sprawled out on my fucking bed. But like, she's still like, she's like Scout. Like, she still has to touch me, but only like the side of my leg. And she kind of doesn't want to be bothered. She did sleep through the night last night. I was really shocked. You told me she was napping when I got home?
Yeah, but she only slept for maybe like 45 minutes.
Oh, okay. So I got home at 12:30. Took her right to bed, and we woke up at 8:30 this morning. No disruptions.
Yeah, I mean, we were running around doing a lot of shit all day.
Gotta cherish these moments, you know. They grow up so fast,
Brian.
Like the small window of when they're actually a puppy is,
I know,
like, it's
so gonna
small.
Be brutal. We're gonna go on that cruise, and we come back, and she's gonna be a fucking dog.
I was thinking about that yesterday. I was like, oh my god, when we come back from the cruise, you're gonna be fucking huge. You might be bigger than Scout.
It's close.
How long are we gonna be gone for? About 10
week,
days almost.
But I'm taking her to her trainer, who's gonna board her. I take her tomorrow, because he only does 2 weeks at a time. So I had the choice of doing a week after the cruise or a week prior, and I felt like it was probably better to get her training sooner than later. So I take her tomorrow, and then I'm gonna train with her next Thursday, and then gone for a week. Head into the WPT
more than a week, because we're leaving a couple days early.
That's true. That is true. Yeah, it's about
nine days.
Yeah. Oh, Pippers, don't you get too big. We We got the other pups here too. You can't see them, but Gatsby and Scout, they're chilling.
They're chilling. They're such good brothers and sisters. Well, Scout really doesn't just want nothing to do with her, but Gatsby, he's such a good brother.
He's the best.
She was like laying next to him yesterday. She's so cute together.
That's what I'm waiting for is the
Daddy girl.
The two of them just like, I have pictures of Scout when she was a pup.
Yeah.
And she was, you're talking about the Harden thing?
Yes.
Yeah, obviously. Man, just no patience.
Can't wait.
This is like 4 days old. I don't know what happened. I mean, it was a 21-point game, so I guess Harden was like, fuck it. But he he basically defended... I don't know what you're cutting to, or Guap.
I just put in Harden defending Kawhi.
Oh, it just wasn't there yet.
No, it was. It was after.
Wow.
This is not it either. It's in the chat.
Can't believe we got demonetized for that.
I know. We didn't. Such a waste.
Here we go.
But the even funnier part is that Kawhi misses the shot.
Wrong chat. Yeah, so he guard.
Kawhi misses the shot, but I think Harden gets the rebound. They get the points anyway.
Yeah, but he said in the interview, he was like, I was just trying to, you know, keep up team spirit. He was like, it would have been great if he made the shot, but, you know, who cares?
What if he had blocked it?
That'd be hilarious.
Swats him into the fucking sixth row. Like, this is totally uncontested, by the way. Kawhi gets kicked. He kicks out to Kawhi, and Harden is for sure the closest person within like 10 yards.
Do we have video of it?
Yeah, it's coming right now.
The audience has no idea.
I just put it in
about.
Podcast assets.
All right. Well, yeah.
Or podcast chat.
I heard it.
He went,
Pring. I think I did.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Poor Kawhi, bro. We just fucking.
I know. It's just like here.
Put the wrong one.
Oh my God.
Oh all right, my.
Moving
God.
On.
This is what you said.
Enough
me.
Is enough. This is it.
Oh, this is it.
So good.
So fucking good.
The NBA is a fucking clown show.
What's this
man.
Guy up to?
You know, the Celtics already clinched the first seed with like 15 games left or 14
record,
games left.
Their team damn. Is absurd. I hope they choke.
They've been
at some
playing.
Point,
they've been playing
them.
Their bench. Their bench players for the last like.
I hate them so much, I hope they choke, but their team is absolutely absurd. Whatever Brad Stevens is getting paid for putting that team together, it should be double.
I wonder what the percentages are of the number one seed winning the NBA championship compared to like a number one seed winning the NCAA.
Ooh.
I mean, obviously like the NCAA is like significantly lower. Well,
yeah there's 64 teams.
But there's four number one seeds.
Yeah. So it kind of evens it out.
Okay, so 16.
Not evens it out, but, you know.
It's close. Yeah. I mean, how many make it in the NBA? 16? Eight each side? Nine each side now, right? There's a play-in?
Yeah, so it's... I think it's six in the playoffs, right? Because the play-in brings in two.
Mm-hmm. So eight total?
So either you can lock up...
I thought it was nine total with the play-in, and then it became eight.
That makes sense.
Okay, maybe.
Yeah, I could be wrong. It could be six and seven.
No, that's
but
right.
I think
it
that's
has
right.
to be.
Okay, so yeah, 18 teams make it. There's two one seeds, so it's the equivalent of nine.
Because it's like hockey. You need to win 16 games to win the championship.
Right. Right. So NCAA, it's like 1-16 versus 1-9 at the NBA. But the difference is that the skill gap in the NBA between one and every and the field is probably much, much, much larger, I would imagine. Maybe not, though. I don't know because like...
I think in the old... Back in the days...
That was probably true.
That the skill gap was larger in NCAA back in the day.
I was going to say back in the day, it was probably more true in the NBA because it seems like people don't care about the regular season in the NBA anymore.
Yeah.
Like they're fine to get a six seed and just like LeBron's teams were notorious for this, right? Like they just didn't really lock up the one seed all that often, the Heat and the Cavs the second time around.
Yeah, I don't think that was a choice, but...
Well, a lot of it... I mean, they make decisions with, like, a month or two to go in a lot of situations where it's just, like, it's not worth exhausting your team. Because I don't know for sure, but as far as I understand, like, home court doesn't matter all that much in the NBA.
It's not just the advantage. For Game 7 for the most part. I mean, it does, because it's, like, if
I
you get to Game 7...
I always, it's so funny. It's totally backwards to me how it works. But I would have thought that in sports where there's a natural advantage to being at home, that the edge would be to the home player more. And it's almost the exact inverse. So I would have thought baseball would be the number one sport where home field matters the most.
Okay.
Because you get the bat last, right? Like you effectively get to operate the clock. You get to make the last decisions, all that other stuff. And then I would have thought basketball would be second in the playoffs anyway, because of best of seven.
Okay.
And then maybe hockey third, because you at least get final line change. So there are like inherent things in the sport that give the home team the advantage.
Best of seven.
Yeah, and it's also best of seven on top of that. And so there are like inherent things that give the home team slight advantages, right? Like slight EV edges. But it's the exact inverse. NFL is by far, it's not even
remotely
close. So
that's what I was about to say. NFL, you have so much more home field advantage.
Not even close. Yeah. And I think what it is probably, I had this discussion with Andy a lot, and I think it comes down to a couple things. I think it comes down to very low sample size because you're only playing one game a week. So each game just matters a ton. And then on top of that, I think like travel is just a massive aspect to it as well as like crowd noise.
Yeah, right, for sure.
So crowd noise plays a certain aspect of it, but I think travel probably even more so than that plays a huge role in it. Because like baseball, you travel, you're just on the road for like 10 days.
You're just used to it.
Yeah. It's not even just that you're used to it, but it's like it's not a one-game situation. Like you go play a best-of-three series. Mm-hmm. In a place, you've been in that place for 5 days to play a three-game set.
Yeah.
You know, and then you go to the neighboring city that's only 100 miles down the road.
Yeah.
And you play another three-game set.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I'm just surprised that there's no statistical advantage to batting last as far as, like, any of the numbers demonstrate in baseball. That's, like, shocking to me.
Right.
I mean, I think the NFL advantage is because, like, play calling and stuff like that. Like you do, like audibling at the line and stuff like that. You're not being able to hear anything.
Yeah, a little bit of crowd noise for sure. Like, I think if I recall, Andy said it was NFL, NBA, NHL, then baseball as far as home field goes.
Because like you don't change your approach that much in the ninth inning. Based on like what you need, you know what I mean. Like if you're down, like, I mean you do.
Oh, of
I guess
course you
what,
do.
You do, but I don't think like as much, right? Sure, if it's like a one run game as opposed to like a five run game, I guess. But like you're still up there just trying to make good at bats and get on base, right? Regardless of like I just don't think your strategy changes that much as you think it would.
Well, your strategy gets to change some because you get to. Like, you get to exhaust your bench if you want to, but it's not even just that. It's more so just the inherent edge of being able to end the game, right? Like, it comes down to, it's similar to, like, the old NFL overtime rules.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want the ball first or second?
Right.
Right? Like, you always wanted it. Did you want it first or second? Whenever you could end it on a touchdown.
You always wanted it first.
Yeah.
Right. So that was the new NFL rules.
Right. But the thing is that, that's because you're getting that extra possession where the other team is not. Where in baseball, you're still getting the same amount of possessions.
It's not extra, right?
Right. You're still getting your nine at bats or your nine innings each.
Yeah.
Right. So like
I guess it's just like, is there advantage to knowing what you need to win?
That's what I'm saying. And I'm saying no. There's not. There's not that much of an advantage because your approach doesn't change with that knowledge. Like, your strategy just doesn't change that much with the knowledge of knowing what you need.
Somebody said positive outcomes are harder in MLB versus other sports. And I think
that's
very
true. Yeah, that's very,
very true. Very, very true.
Hockey, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Hockey, too. So, like, that, I guess that makes sense why both of them are lower in spite of having inherent advantages. But, yeah, it's like the three... I guess maybe if we looked at strictly playoffs, it might be different. But the three sports that have best of seven... playoff series, best of five, best of seven, also still ranked below the NFL, which is just a one of one. And I guess maybe that makes sense. Like if you only get one game and it's an elimination game, like they're always playing a best of seven.
Right.
Or they're always playing a game seven, I should say.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess that makes some sense. I don't know. It's interesting. It's a little bit counterintuitive to me, but I think you're probably right in that it just comes down to overall strategy, like the EV of your strategy.
Right.
All right, let's get to an In the Muck.
Might be enough. Okay, so we are back in the muck. We have a user submission from Joel Will Flip. That's what it is. Joel Will Flip. He's playing 1-2, and they're five-handed. Under the gun raises to five. And he has the ace seven of diamonds on the button and decides to 3-bet to 13, so about 2.5x, and the under the gun calls. We have a flop of 10 of diamonds, 4 of hearts, 5 of clubs, and Landon was like, oh, nice, it's a heads up pot, this is perfect for this, you know, perfect for everything. And then it broke because the under the gun decides to lead for 14, which is half pot. We decide to call, and the turn with our backdoors. The turn is the 6 of spades, completing the badoogie and giving us a open ender. Now under the gun checks. We decide to go for it. We bet 2/3 pot, 32 into 57. I guess it's a little less. And we were met with a call. And then the river bricks 9 of spades. And some under the gun checks. And we decide to go all in for 82, or put him all in for $82 more into a 121. And we're met with a call by the ace jack offsuit.
So, ooh.
They were a non-believer.
They were right. I don't know what I don't like something.
Okay, I don't like a lot of things.
Yeah. There's a lot of things to discuss here, for sure.
Okay, so any news and notes from the poster?
Yes, there were actually a lot.
I like his line.
There's $82 with 120 in the middle. The guy's never folding river.
What?
He's just full fucking cold with ace jack.
Yeah, but like we don't know he's not folding right. anything.
That's I think checking on the turn is a thing, right? As the hero?
Yeah, so on the flop, he said, this is where I was really confused. The 10 high board should not hit under the gun very much. I think he should have ace 10 suited down to jack 10 suited, pocket 10s, and would have checked raised some of those instead of leading half pot. There might be a small amount of ace 4 suited, ace 5 suited. He should not have any two pair in range, and sets of 4s, 5s should be discounted but not eliminated due to the small 3-bet size, and so on and so forth.
Okay, so this is...
Yeah.
Wait, who 3-bet here?
The imposition.
The button.
Okay. Yeah, oh, yeah, sorry. So this is
our hero 3-bet.
Under the gun versus button, not big blind versus button. Okay.
Right. Under the gun opened.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay, so this looks like
five-handed hijack versus button.
Yeah, and we arrive at flop with like 4 SPR.
This guy did not start with 100 bigs.
Right, correct.
Out of position.
Yeah, so he was trying to figure out, you know, what is his donk lead here? You know, he's like, does he have like 6s through 9s? Does he have...
I don't think we care.
Yeah.
I don't think we care. I would personally set this up. I just would not allow someone to break flow here and play calls. I see no reason to have a calling range here. I
agree.
I'm exaggerating. Obviously, we have some hands that want to call here.
We just have such an advantage in this hand, right? It's just like we have the back doors. We have
the overpairs.
We have the nut advantage, but our specific hand has back doors, and now they're like leading into us. They're breaking flow, which is just so weird. And it's just like, I would almost always raise as well.
I just raise blindly here.
I think the problem is like when we play call on the flop, we are positioning our hand in some weird portion of range that is both a bluff catcher as well as a potential future bluff.
Yeah, if you have jacks or queens here, you're not just calling.
That has nothing to do with our hand, though. But I mean, yes, you're correct.
Right.
What's more specific, though, is like where does our hand, if you're thinking about like the overall breakdown of our range, where does our hand fit as far as future streets go? So like when we're obviously playing no fold here because our hand has backdoor straight, backdoor flush, and we have an overcard. So it's too good to give up versus half pot. But when we call, we've now set ourselves up for like an SPR of 2 less, like 1.5, right? There's no 2.
No,
2. So it then becomes an issue of like, well, how do we win this pot later unimproved, right? And the challenge becomes like, well, it's just hard to. You basically, your edge here is not bluffing a future street because you have a weird hand to do it with, right? Like, you're going to improve such as we did with a 6, but now, like, I'm almost feeling incentivized to check back.
Yeah, you feel like once you call the flop, now you're just like at the mercy of the deck. The deck has to kind of almost like save you. You know what I mean?
I think you're more at the mercy of the out of position player.
Well, yeah, but that's what I mean. Like you just need to like improve. Like if the turn's, I don't know, a brick, a deuce, like are you going to like blast off? Or like what if they lead again? Like, you know what I mean?
If they lead again, we have a call and then a fold. That's right. Fine. I'm more concerned about what happens when it's the deuce of diamonds and we face another lead. Like, sure, we're just going to end up having a call down.
Right.
But my point is we have better hands to do this with that fit naturally into a bluff-catching portion of our range, and A7's not that.
Right.
We have hands like ace-jack of diamonds, ace-queen of diamonds. Those hands can just like comfortably call multiple streets, and we're mostly way ahead of a leading range. With ace-7, it's kind of like having queen-jack, or maybe not to that degree, but it's kind of like having like king-queen, no backdoor. Mm-hmm. We're never folding that hand versus a lead. Right? Like if we have king, queen of spades here, we're just not folding versus a lead. But it's like almost a little bit too good to be a pure bluff and not quite good enough to be a pure bluff catcher.
Mm-hmm. And that's important because I think people fold there a lot.
I was about to say,
if
I have king, queen of spades here and I see a lead, I have no back doors except for two overs. I think I just let it go.
But they're just doing something so stupid.
No, right. Yeah, for sure. I get it. Right.
So it's just like no good hand can really be incentivized to do what this person's doing. Nothing good wants to bet half pot. Like, okay, sometimes he's going to have a 10, but like most of his 10x is going to be like king 10, queen 10 suited, and we now block those. So like having king queen here is really nice. My point that I'm arriving at is I know I'm raising all my overpairs because I want to get them all in, and I want to reduce this to a two street game where I'm all in on turns. Like I don't want to call with jacks and have an overcard fall. I don't want to call with queen. There's no trapping here unless I have tens.
Right.
Right. So it's like I know I'm playing raise with my 10x or better.
Maybe aces.
Yeah, maybe aces.
Right.
That's fine.
At a frequency.
And like, you know, your aces will balance like your ace 5 suited and your ace 4 suited. But like, you just don't need to have very many calls here. So my calls, I would restrict to having like hands that like turn really fucking well on like favorable cards for us. Because the 6 is not favorable for our range. That's the reason why this bluff fails. The 6 doesn't help us.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't call our overpairs. So when the 6 comes and he checks and we bet, what the fuck you got?
Right.
The fuck you got, man? You have 10-9 suited? God bless you. Yeah. Show me 10-9 suited. I'm calling you down with ace-jack.
Yeah.
Right? Because like it just doesn't make any logical sense. And for that reason, in spite of the fact that I think out of position played their hand terribly, I actually don't think it's that... I mean, it's not a great bluff catcher, but it's also not the worst.
Matt, against this player profile, you're never trapping with aces and kings?
Maybe aces.
Okay.
Only aces, though. But, like, why? Why trap? A lot of his leads are going to be these middling hands, like 6-7, 6-8, 8-7, 9-8, 10x. You know what I mean? It's just like, get the money. Get the money now while getting's good. And then take hands like this. Take hands like Broadways, king-queen, king-jack, queen-jack. Raise them.
Bluffs.
And just raise them and be all in every time you improve on the turn. Right? Because that's what you're doing with your overpairs. If we're not raising A7, what are we complementing kings and queens and jacks with?
Yeah.
Right? How do we have an ace when we raise flop and turn comes ace?
Mm-hmm.
What do we have? Right? I would pretty much... I'm struggling to see calls here outside of pocket tens. Because even ace 5, ace 4 suited, pretty happy to just raise them on the flop. Mm-hmm. Give us some ace X coverage. Like... Sure, I don't mind calling ace king, ace queen, ace jack some of the time, but also I don't need to.
We're gonna go to the Wizards and be like, ace 7 of diamonds is a pure call.
Well, it's just gonna start smoking because it's like bro doesn't get leads on 10-4-5.
Right.
The whole point I'm getting at here, the bigger takeaway is that the initial instinct to not fold our hand because it has too much equity to do so is good. The problem is assigning so much equity to it that it's too good to bluff. And I disagree with that. I think we have a very natural two-barrel all-in here. Yeah. I think we raise half pot on flop, and then we jam turn when check two. And if he shows up with ace-jack high and he calls down, God bless him.
Like if you if you took that line, ace-jack... Well, ace-jack just probably just goes in the muck on the flop.
It should.
And if it doesn't, it almost certainly doesn't the turn.
And if it doesn't, then like he's torching anyway. Who gives a shit?
Yeah.
Exactly. All right. Child of the Sim.
Child of the Sim. Sim us.
Why do you always look so sad?
Because it's broken. You broke my toy. Well, it's,
you were so excited when you saw like the pre-flop construction of this hand. You're like, oh, this is going to be great. And then the flop came. You're like, oh.
No.
So sad.
Yeah, I mean, it's all locked because he has no leads. Leads don't exist. So I had to just like pretend that he leads enough of the time to get ace-jack to be in there a mild amount, which probably, whatever.
Okay.
So here he goes. He leads half pot. And then ace-7 with the diamond specifically, we just play pure call. The other ones we can raise, like hearts we want to raise. And it's because he can't have 10x of a flush draw with the diamond suits, right? Like jack 10 of hearts, jack 10 of clubs. So when we have ace x of diamonds, we don't block it, so we don't want to raise. But this is theory. It's obviously not that important when you're playing.
Can you explain that a little bit more to me? Because I feel like it would be the opposite. I feel like raising ace-7 of clubs becomes dangerous because he could have just 10x of clubs.
I think the idea is we just dominate his flush draws in that regard, that he can't, like...
Oh, so like when we call, we keeping queen jack of diamonds.
We also just block, like he might have jack 10 of clubs and that's fine, but we also block ace 10 suited with ace 7 of clubs.
Right.
Right. So it's more likely he's going to have a fold.
I see. That makes more sense.
Like he has like ace 10 suited that leads. He has king 10, jack 10.
Okay.
So, and we also just have equity with the overcard if he does somehow.
I told you the wizard always has a way of like, you know, throwing a curveball.
Top card suit, you want to play call.
Okay.
Ace 6, you can raise. Ace 6, not as good as ace 7. Like you're like the idea of raise is very real. Like you just raise a quarter of the time because you're like, what the fuck do you have?
These hands are also just like folding at a really high frequency.
Yeah, I mean this portion of the range. Yeah, like ace nine.
Like you can see king queen suited doesn't fold even the spade variety, as I said.
Yeah. Well, that's because of
you can raise if you want.
That's
actually.
Because of the lead range that you gave him, which is probably
he didn't give it to him though.
I just locked the strategy.
He forced the theoretical.
Yeah. I didn't give like random hands. I just said okay, lead enough of the time to make ace jack lead sometimes.
Yeah. Gotcha.
We even lead ace jack here too, like ace of clubs jack. Raise. Sorry, we raise ace queen even like somebody's a little bit off. Ace king sure, ace king's like a value raise sort of. And it's like you raise and. Let's just go through the line and they go all in. You're just like, well, okay, I have ace king. Like, that's a pretty good hand.
Yeah.
Backdoor flush, I can win. So, anyways, we call, turns a six. And he, like, splits into, like, a, I guess it's a two-ear check strategy, like something along those lines. But
the villain.
Yeah, the villain can. The villain.
It's more than 2E.
Yeah, it looks like a little more. Yeah, it's a lot more.
Yeah, 2E's like 60%.
He checks. Button goes like a little bit smaller because you're trying to target the high cards, I suppose, or like the small pairs.
Right.
So A7, you can kind of mix. Mostly going to want to bet for the bigger size just because you're not going to get check jammed on very often.
Right.
And you are going to have aces and kings that trap, so your value is still going to be value heavy.
Yeah. You want to have some ace coverage whenever the river comes in ace 2.
Yep. You do raise ace 10 on flop versus the bet just like kind of pure because that hand needs the most protection and value.
Yep.
So... we go like a little bit bigger, so we just like just 60.
Yeah, 60 becomes a bit of a problem because now you set up about 60% river shove.
And you still bluff, but like not as much.
Less often, yeah.
But you still check because like you want to have some straight sometimes. You still beat some things from his range. Like you look back, you still beat some queen jacks that might check or whatever. Beat some king jacks. So even though you have ace high, you still have some showdown value some of the time. So we bet, and then ace jack's supposed to fold, but he didn't. He said, you. And then the river's a 9. And now that we're here, it's like we don't have showdown value anymore. So now I would jam if I had the option. And you still sort of mix it, but like you can kind of do what you want. Jam's going to be fine. Check back, like you don't really win. It's going to be okay. Checking back ace 3 is a little
It's cut off from the screen, so we can't actually see how often it's jamming.
It being...
A7.
It's like... 40% of the time.
Okay.
60% check back.
Yep.
Ace 3 is a pure check. I guess because in the machine, like lead range, like they have threes that like check, or that lead sometimes because fuck it, we have threes. And then they turn open ended and they don't want to bet anymore.
Right.
So now when you have ace 3, you block some of the lightest hands that are going to fold. So you don't want to bluff with ace 3.
Makes sense.
So ace 7, you don't block a 3. So that's good. That's good for you.
Right.
Ace jack, a good one to jam just because you have good blockers to 10x. King jack, low showdown value. King Jack of Spades is going to be like a nice bluff here. King Queen as well that floats versus the lead because he led half pot, so we have to call. And then once he checks the turn, like it's a good hand to just kind of go for it with a little bit.
Yeah.
Especially if you have some good suits blocking King 10 suited and Queen 10 suited. So when we jam, Ace Jack's supposed to fold the turn, but he didn't. So like that's his problem, right? Like calling loses like six.
I mean, he's still, he's losing a with lot. Ace Queen too. So Ace like Queen. Ace King becomes like the bluff catch.
Yeah, and even this, who even knows how much it flats pre to the three bet?
Right, probably doesn't exist.
No
just
idea.
Just gotta start calling pairs.
Yeah, like sevens probably has to call a lot. Like I would just call sevens pure probably as this guy if I ever took a line like this.
Yeah, agreed.
What the hell?
What you got?
Yeah, Jack 10, I'd always call like. Jack's quote unquote mixing folds. Never
yeah, happened, I think like now looking at the sim, I think what we can understand is that because, in my opinion, we don't have enough bluffs on the flop versus lead, turn and river get massively overbluffed. So I actually think out of position generates a fair amount of EV for really, really, really bad hands whenever he chooses to lead and then check, right? Because, in position is just going to play such a transparent strategy of value raising flop with most everything. And then floating, so to speak. Don't at me. Don't at me. But yeah, like calling with the intention to take the pot away later with so many marginal middle of range type of hands, right? And, you know, you can discredit hands like eights and sevens. They're probably not going to start betting turn and river. They might bet one of those two streets, but not both. So you just end up being against a lot of no pair hands. And ace queen and ace king aren't good bluffs through this line. So it's just like, what you got, man? You know? Mm-hmm. What you got? And it's like, if he shows you 7-6, God bless him. He deserves it. Otherwise, like ace jack high, YOLO.
Hey.
I don't hate it. I don't hate it even though it's torching in theory. Basically, I don't hate it because I think that the lead causes a big imbalance by the response. And, you know, it's tough for it not to because it's hard to study something that doesn't exist. But this goes back to what I was saying where it's like, this is what I was saying on the early part of the show. If you're constantly trying to replicate something that you've seen, some theoretical output, be it a pre-flop chart or a post-flop sim, if you're constantly just trying to replicate what the machine does without really a deep understanding of like how it arrived at those conclusions, then ultimately you do put yourself in this position to be wildly imbalanced in game, right? Because you can understand that A7 just has high enough equity that it can't fold flop. But actually, it folds half the time. And when it doesn't fold, it plays a mix of raise and call. And now all of a sudden, whenever we miss those mixes, which you're going to miss them pretty across the board if you're not really confident in how you're supposed to respond to not a thing, then all of a sudden like they naturally back you into a pretty big imbalance where you're just weak a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I call you weak.
Yeah. I call you weak.
Call you weak.
Yeah.
All right. Just know in the future I call you weak.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I know, sir. Yes, sir.
Maybe this was those two guys playing this hand.
I call you weak. You know that from now on, right?
You remember that hand, right?
It
was what? Queens versus jacks?
It was queens versus or kings versus jacks or something like that. He's like, I knew I had to turn it into a bluff. I couldn't beat you.
Yeah.
I call you weak from now on.
Yeah. Like jacks, like, four bet ripped it pre and queens folds face up. He's like, oh, okay, boy.
It's the only thing I could do. Only way I had to do it.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I call you weak.
It's so mad.
I would love to get those two on the podcast.
Very sad that it was staged.
Was it really? No.
Confirmed?
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense. Like, who just captures that?
Yeah.
Right.
You know, like, who just gets... It seems so authentic. The response was so pure.
Very Southern, you know?
Yeah. It just seemed like exactly what somebody who was ashamed that they got bluffed off a good hand would say.
I mean, I see this all the time in the stakes I play.
Me
these
too.
These conversations.
Hey, me too, buddy.
In the
me
stakes.
Too.
Well, honestly, like it literally comes full circle. Like, what happens in your game happens in like my games, but like doesn't happen in the 10-20 game.
Yeah, I talked about this last week. Yeah, I said the same thing.
Right.
Yeah. No, yeah. It's true. That's you know why? They're all fucking playing their
one
charts.
1-2 is 1-2, man. Whether it's right. How many, doesn't matter how many zeros
in the
10-20
game, they're all playing their fucking charts. Yeah. Behind the glass, everybody's free to do as they wish.
Yep.
A lot of monkeys just throwing poo. I'm in there. I'm in there. Yeah, I think like the final takeaway here is it's important to teach yourself how to freestyle.
Yeah,
it's very critical because people will freestyle against you because they lack a strategy, and you need to understand how to like maximally exploit that in real time. And it's a hard skill to acquire, but it does require just putting some time and thought into certain situations that may pop up in your game. And just understanding like when people themselves are imbalanced towards strong hands versus weak. In this situation, I think they're pretty strongly imbalanced towards weak. If you guys would like to submit your own in the muck, we would be happy to go over it. Hit hashtag Discord in the chat or go to our Twitter page at Solve4Y. It's the pinned tweet. You can follow that to our Discord channel. We have an entire forum set up for In the Muck. We're looking forward to your submissions. As always, the Tort taking the lead.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry, guys. We're going to get in public speaking classes soon. He's gonna get a lot better at this.
I'm trying.
Big reminder, too. Don't forget, we have two academies in May. Cash Game Academy, we have a full table already, but we're going to open a second one, so be sure to sign up for that. It's May 23rd to the 25th. The MTT Academy, we are approaching a full first table. That is going to be led by Matt Hunt. It's actually a four-day academy, so you get an extra day for the same price as the cash. Right before the WSOP, that's going to be May 27th to the 30th. Be sure to sign up soon. That's going to do it for us today. I think we covered appropriately how not to be a Mizreg in spite of the fact that we did not tap into the Reddit thread. I'm sure we'll have this heading six or seven more times.
Now,
yeah,
just to do it.
Yeah, the bit is that when Nikki sends us Reddit posts, I don't do them. That's going to do it for us. Say goodbye to Pip. You'll see her in a couple of weeks.
Let me
get Pip up.
Oh. Oh. You just see her. There she is.
Sign off, Pippers.
Look at that ear.
Say, I'll be back in 2 weeks after the WBT voyage trip.
She's going to be huge.
Oh, she's going to be a big girl. We'll see you guys all noon on Monday.
Peace.
Later, squad.